Hey bosses, before we kick off this episode, I want to tell you about our friends over at NetSuite. Now, if your business earns millions or tens of millions of revenue, first of all, congratulations. But second of all, you need to stop what you're doing and take a listen because NetSuite by Oracle has just rolled out the best offer we've ever seen. NetSuite gives you the visibility and control you need to make better decisions faster. And for the first time in NetSuite's 22 years as the number one cloud financial system, you can defer payments a full 6 months for the entire NetSuite implementation. That's no payments and no interest for 6 months. And you can take advantage of this special financing offer today. It's no interest, no payments. Take advantage of this special financing offer at netsuite.com/ilab. That's netsuite.com/ilab to get the visibility and control you need to weather any storm. One more time, it's netsuite.com/ilab. All right, let's kick off this episode of Invest Like a Boss.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
I'm Derek Spartz.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Welcome back, bosses. Episode 274. Did I get that right? 274.
I just said it 3 seconds ago, Sam.
I just finished boxing class and I haven't gotten punched that many times in my life, but today I got punched in the temple really hard. And I have a lot more respect for boxers because it looks like they were playing with a big glove, like a pillow on their hand. Dude, it really hurts when you get hit with a boxing glove.
I haven't boxed just for fun and like since I was a teenager. And that sucked. I was like, why would I want to do this? This is awful. Yeah. My head hurts. I don't remember what happened. I'm good.
You taste the knuckles. Like you see, those knuckles go through the gloves. I got punched in the mouth.
The padding doesn't do much for you.
I got punched in the mouth and I had a mouthpiece in and I could still feel like the knuckles hitting my teeth through the glove, through my lip, and I thought it chipped my tooth. Fortunately not, but yeah, 274. Welcome back. So last week, Derek, actually, we were talking about Ponzi schemes. I love the topic. We did a one-on-one episode and we covered the top five Ponzi schemes of all time.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't think I brought this up to you, but I was talking to a new advertiser that's probably going to come to the show and they're like, oh, what topics are you talking about? And I go, oh, we're talking about Ponzi schemes. Do you want to be on that episode? And they're like, we want to be as far away from that episode as possible.
Oh, man, I didn't really think of that. True.
We're scared away sponsors, but we're doing it for you guys. So maybe that's why you don't hear about Ponzi schemes on other podcasts, because no one wants to touch it.
Yeah, not advertiser friendly, depending on the category. But I think that episode, and especially the research going into that episode, really made us think about what we're investing in, take a much more sharp look around. And on this episode, I know you got a great guest lined up, Derek. Why don't you tell us a little bit about who's coming on the show?
Yeah, so we got David Shapiro coming on. He is a professor now. He's worked with the FBI. He helped break up multiple Ponzi schemes, financial crimes. I think his biggest one was the KPMG one a few years back, which was over $1 billion in fraud found. He had a big role in that. He specializes in finding, you know, shady accounting, things of that measure. He's also keeping up on some of the new Ponzi schemes he's going to bring us up. Definitely cryptocurrency in the last few years has been a big one. Identity theft, the dark web, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. He knows all about these things. And these are potential investments that we may cover on Invest Like a Boss. We talk about alternative investments and there's always a risk to those. And we just want to put the word out there that, you know, sometimes you got to do your diligence and some signs to look out for that maybe something isn't right.
And sometimes all the due diligence in the world is not going to help you out, because I think you'll come to find out. And on this episode, we'll talk about just how difficult it is, even for people that are on the board of directors, to see what's actually happening in the day-to-day transactions and in the financials. That can get very, very complicated. And if you guys haven't yet checked it out, be sure to watch the Madoff series on Netflix. I think that's a lot of what the inspiration was behind us putting these kind of back-to-back episodes together. It's fantastic. I want to say it's five episode series. Does that sound right, Derek?
I'm just looking right now. It is four episodes It came out in January of this year. It's called The Monster of Wall Street. I'll put a link to it in the show notes too. Definitely worth checking out, even if it's not 100% accurate. I know documentaries like to embellish some things, and there's a couple cheesy acting moments with the fake Madoff guy, but overall there's like a lot of good information in there.
The fake Madoff guy is so good too. He's like he should get some type of award for that. He probably will. So let's go into the interview, Derek. I have some news to share about a Ponzi scheme. That was it, a Ponzi scheme? I'm not sure. Some type of fraud that I was investing in, and I'm gonna have more details on that afterwards.
Ooh, way to tease it, Sam. All right, let's get into the interview. This is David Shapiro on Invest Like a Boss. I have David Shapiro on. He is our expert in financial crime. This topic came about because Sam and I had realized that we watched this documentary about Bernie Madoff on Netflix, and we're like, this can't be the only one that's going on. There has to be a lot of these financial crimes, Ponzi schemes going on. So we're like, we got to get an expert on. And that's why, David, you're on the show. Thanks for coming on Invest Like a Boss.
You're welcome.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into the whole world of financial crimes?
Well, certainly. Long and short of it is I am an attorney and CPA, retired, but I worked a couple of years in the FBI, worked as a prosecutor, worked as a management consultant. And anyway, I fell into financial crimes because it's a natural marriage of law and accounting. I think that that's probably, to anticipate our talk, one of the problems that we have in sort of monitoring and assessing investments is the lack of knowledge of accounting and law.
So I think we'll get into some of the ways that you can discover this financial fraud going on further in a bit. But can you tell us about some of the biggest financial crimes that you've helped discover? Do you have any examples, like dollar amounts or maybe some cases we might have heard of?
Well, yeah, probably. Probably heard of the tax shelter case involving, among others, KPMG a few years ago. And I think they settled this overall settlement among the guilty parties or parties that pled guilty was over $1 billion and for escaping or evading taxes of $500 million. I played a not so insignificant role in that, I'm proud to say, in discovering conduct at a certain bank, which essentially performed the function of finding customers that were willing to invest in so-called tax shelters.
So the bank had willingly known that they were doing wrong, but they would go out and actively seek customers anyways.
Well, that's a great question. Knowingly doing wrong, is that's what's interesting about it, because people invariably do not regard themselves as doing wrong, even when they are. Like, oh, this is what everybody does. This is justified. Yeah, technically against the rules, but you know, everybody's doing it. It's how anybody makes a sound return. It's just part of doing business. And it's not really egregious, like going into an elementary school and gunning down 35 children. It's not directly stealing your neighbor's car. It's sort of like a white collar crime that some bizarrely perceive as victimless. But as we'll get to later, as I'm sure you recognize, these financial crimes are hardly victimless.
For sure. So let's start off about how to spot fraud. I noticed that when Sam and I did our episode on Ponzi schemes, we went through some of the history of these Ponzi schemes, and we noticed that a lot of them came about in 2008 when the economy crashed. And now we're in a weird kind of spot in the economy where, you know, things were really good for a long time, and now we're starting to see some cracks in there. So we kind of theorize that maybe this is a time that some of these more bigger schemes could come to light when the economy starts to go down. So is there any telltale signs that the average retail investor or listener of our show could look for to identify potential fraud?
Well, there are basically two ways. And what you're describing are severe liquidity crunches in 2008 and what's going on right now as we speak. And sometimes it's especially hard to tell from the financial statements because there is a category of accounting called commitments and contingencies. And that's sort of what they call off balance sheet. And in there, you'll often find risks that could blow up a company, such as Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns. And so you can't always go by the four corners of the financial statements. That said, you need to look at financial statements because, number one, to find out whether they're audited, and having a Big Four auditor sign off, while no guarantee against wrongdoing, is certainly something that provides more comfort.
Right, because that's a huge liability for the auditing firm. Should it be a fraud?
So you look for that. And then, you know, you look for, well, who's behind it? Who are the sponsors? Who are the key players, the directors, the executives? What are their ties? And for better and worse, there is so much interlocking power in American business that you see it's kind of frightening because individuals are tied to one another in very surprising ways. And not to impugn the reputation of Henry Kissinger, for example, but he was on the board of directors of Theranos. So if you look at Theranos in the event to maybe discover some kind of financial crime, you'll, oh, Henry Kissinger on the board. What could go wrong? A reputable guy like that? This has got to be on the up and up. But to be on the up and up requires somebody somewhere doing deep financial due diligence, not just of the figures, but also of the figures, the persons creating the financial statements, management. And that's something where we often see one of these, you know, one pointing to the other. Well, he must have done some work. She must have done some work.
Right.
And we rely on credentials and reputations. And the person might not even looked at the financial statements and maybe just getting paid a $20,000 sponsorship to be on the board for a quarter or so.
Yeah, I think we see that a lot with you know, boards of directors, CEOs, things of that matter, throwing someone else under the bus saying that I had no idea what's going on in my own company.
Yeah. You know, plausible deniability. And to what extent, you have to ask, was this person incentivized to actually look for wrongdoing? It's very easy to be motivated to overlook things when you get paid not to make waves. And when you're getting a decent buck for a couple hours of work a month, you know, it's hard for the board of directors to govern. And they're basically charged with being the check on management. And if the board of directors don't have the time or the inclination to do so, it sort of makes you feel for the outside investor who really cannot get access better than a director, but has to rely on what he or she has been told through public reports and maybe short selling hints. You know, the short interest may be a key, but it, you know, it's not easy. So you can choose to err on the side of false positives. Okay, smells not so good, I'm not going to invest, and maybe miss out on the occasional sound investment that provides alpha return. Alpha return. Or you can just false negatives. Well, it's not really a problem. Everybody else seems to be doing it. It's popular. Yeah, why not? What have I got to lose? So we have a lot of investors, I don't have to tell you, that fit into one of those two categories and mostly just want to make money.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. And you can't make money without risking money, without taking a chance. So you see how the slippery slope is, you know, oh, you got to take a chance, or you got to trust somebody, or you got to rely on this. Oh, everybody can't be all in on it. You say, okay, here, take my million, you know?
Yeah, totally. So in that Madoff series, I'm not sure if you saw it on Netflix. It was a pretty good, it was about a 3 or 4 episode documentary that went pretty in depth into it. You know, as far as the accuracy is, I'm not 100% sure, but they did have some other information in there where they said one of the telltale signs to see that, you know, maybe something isn't up on the up and up is that Madoff would consistently send statements that had almost the exact same gains every month, like clockwork. You know, whether the economy was up or down or whatever investment he made, the returns were almost exactly the same year by year, month by month. Is that something that you should be scared of if you see an investment that is consistently making consistent returns?
Well, yeah, ordinarily, unless, of course, they're fixed rate investments like bonds and right, so forth, whose underlying value might not vary that much. And I think that Madoff, among other things, advertised a straddle investment strategy. The details were sort of not clear, but I think the idea was that I don't lose too much, I don't gain too much, and that's how I make money in equities at 10% every year, 12% every year, because of my straddles and my knowledge of the market movements. And it seemed plausible enough if you didn't know Madoff's history. If you knew his history, of course, you would see that there were issues dating back to the mid-70s, frankly.
Right. So let's jump into some of the newer financial crimes that you're seeing. One I want to touch on is cryptocurrency. What is your view on cryptocurrencies? I know when they, let's say like 2017 or so, when, you know, Bitcoin was really getting hot and everybody jumped in, there was clearly a lot of fraudulent coins that were essentially just Ponzi schemes. I think we've come to weed a lot of those out, but there's still a lot out there. Is that kind of an easy way in for a fraudster just to mask a scheme as crypto?
Yes. And I don't know the history of your particular investments and advice. So, you know, I want to be polite about this as a guest, but I'm not a big fan of cryptocurrency because
I'm 100% out of cryptocurrency right now, and I couldn't be happier. So,
good.
We're pretty much on the same page across the board on our show. We've had moments where we're really into it and moments where we're not at all. I think we're kind of at the point where it's like, yeah, we're fine with not being involved in it.
Well, the thing is, like anything, I don't have to tell you, it's all about timing. And you could not be into it and think it's a bunch of BS. But let's face it, if you can buy it today with fairly decent certainty that in a month from now it'll be 20% higher, 30% higher, buy it and sell it in a month. You know, there's just not a real passionate long-term commitment to the product. But what I would advise people is to consider the product itself. If the product itself doesn't have any value other than exchange value, like can I exchange it for US dollars? Can I exchange it for British sterling? Versus products that have use value, a farm that produces a ranch, apple orchards, things that people need to use to survive. There you get a better sense of the reality of the prospects. But things like that have only exchange value sometimes operate on a hope and a prayer. FTX's tokens, for example. I mean, what exactly is a token? And why do I need it where money, US dollars, wouldn't suffice? Well, therein lies the rub. Of course, I'll buy it if I'm sure I can sell it next month for 20% over cost. But yeah, then we're getting on what did the CEO of Citibank call it? The musical chairs. I think Chuck Prince called it the musical chairs. So you keep playing that game till the music stops. And do you think you count yourself as lucky? You're going to find a seat when it stops? Yeah, maybe you will, maybe you won't.
So is there anything that we can do? Because some of these coins are definitely, you know, scams and they were just jumping in to cash in on the market. There seems to be cryptocurrency was kind of like the wild, wild west where there wasn't a whole lot you could do. And it just was kind of an instant money grab. I don't know if things have changed in the last few years. If you're aware that is this regulated at all?
Well, the SEC is attempting to regulate it. The Chairman Gensler has been more aggressive than other people and other regulators. I think the CFTC, I think, was doing its kind of sort of till then. But Mr. Gensler is obviously seeking to regulate them as investment contracts, which is what they quite honestly seem to be.
Right.
So and that would require SEC registration, periodic report filing, all that kind of stuff. That is due diligence. It's the kind of due diligence we expect from equities and the kind of due diligence that's not going to eliminate the risk of fraud, but at least to make public what the company is saying that they're doing and puts everybody on a uniform measuring stick so that we can compare companies to other companies in the market. And to date, you really haven't been able to do that because understandably, the crypto coin, the cryptocurrency sellers, the exchanges, the wallets, if you will, have been very reluctant to do that because registration costs money. Why eat into the profits, right?
Exactly. So also, just kind of one more thing on the cryptocurrency front. There's kind of a notion out there that cryptocurrency is used to launder money and do really bad things with it. But my thinking is that everything is tracked and recorded on the blockchain. Doesn't that make it a lot easier to find these laundered funds? So let's say the FBI comes after you and you're laundering money. Isn't it a lot easier to find you if you're using Bitcoin?
That's a great question. And I see it as twofold. You know, the blockchain is great for the purported irreversibility of transactions. Okay. They're memorialized in electronic chunks of data, blocks. But to your point, the money has to get in there from the source and ultimately has to be used. Now, these are the weak points. And there's a great deal of investigative activity. I call it a virtual honey trap activity, because there's a great benefit to be had from law enforcement's perspective, from intelligence agency perspective, when you allow something to be perceived as so secretive and so bulletproof that you can do anything you want and not be found out. It's a good way to smoke out wrongdoers. So to the extent somebody believes that, and I agree with your point, generally, it's a false belief, but it's a belief that people cultivate because they want to lure people into it.
That's interesting. So yeah, I guess law enforcement is fine with that myth being out there because they're like, that just makes our job a lot easier.
Right. I mean, who would invest in Bitcoin? Who would invest in Bitcoin, right? You have your speculators, you have your greater fool investors, but you also have your money launderers, your kiddie porn distributors, your drug dealers. You have a whole lot of stuff that people want to hide. So, you know, you make it accessible only through Tor or something like that. You make it reasonably dark and people think they can get away with something. And I call it virtual honey trap.
That's interesting. So besides cryptocurrency, what are some of the new kind of, I guess, tech financial crimes that you're seeing out there, of ways for people to take advantage of others?
Well, many of them stem from the old-fashioned identity theft, because that is the root of many other thefts. When you are successful in stealing identity, you can do a whole lot of things that maybe are not planned out in advance, right? But basically, any sort of crime that's computer-based, that's cyber-enabled, is more or less popular these days. One, because you can get confederates more easily. It's easier to find people when all you need is to solicit, and you can solicit from Bangladesh, mm-hmm. you know, to Germany. You can solicit in a matter of seconds. And you can also have relationships of convenience, right? Because most products need to be distributed to make a lot of money. You know, the drugs are not going to be grown in a poppy field in Afghanistan and then sold in the suburbs. There's no money in that. So, you know, you have to arrange with persons in other, you know, whether from Mexico City to Miami to, you know, to Vancouver. It's easier to develop that network. And people will want to steal big. You can steal little and you might go under the radar, and you might be able to get away with it without alerting many other persons through a computer-based network. But if you want to steal big, you need confederates, you need a conspiracy, you need a network, because that's the only way to reach scale, right? Selling illegal things is no different from selling anything else. If you don't have scale, you can make a certain amount of money, but not a real lot.
Very interesting. So would you say that the, you know, getting access to someone's data and identity is kind of the key to carte blanche, and then from there, the world is yours?
Well, yeah, because that's the costume. That's the incognito. You can create an identity. It's utterly false. It has no background, no trace. But after a short investigation or intelligence agency workout, you can discover, hey, we've got no record. There's no record of this person by that name anywhere. So sometimes it's easier to have somebody with a track record, maybe a dead person, maybe a child whose social security number you can get, to sort of add plausible deniability, which you lose quickly when you make it up entirely.
Yeah, for sure. So there's a show, I'm sure you've seen it, called American Greed. It runs on like CNBC. They always have some good stories. I find it interesting. I'll catch it every once in a while. It's been on for years. But I've noticed a theme that a lot of the episodes have is that a lot of these Ponzi schemes and fraudulent crimes are targeting the elderly because it's easier to go after them. Maybe they don't know what they're signing up for. Is that still the case today? You're seeing a lot of easy prey on the elderly?
Yeah, my first case in the FBI was some elderly person in Syracuse won a Cadillac in California. All they had to do was pay the sales tax and the Cadillac would be shipped out to them. Obviously a fraud.
So, back in those days, wait. Wait, someone called and said, you've won a Cadillac. All you have to do is, you know, pay the tax or whatever it may
be.
And that was it. Dude, they just didn't question it.
Well, you know what? It's hard to question a gift horse, right? It's hard. Derek, when somebody pays you a compliment, right? Oh, Derek, you're the smartest person I know. What do you say? Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad you appreciate, you know, my intelligence and my commitment and my research and blah, blah, blah. You know, you don't say, well, really? What kind of small circles are you traveling in? You know what I mean? There's a tendency to like accept good news on face value.
Sure.
Now, obviously, many of us will not do this. And that's why they would target the elderly, because for whatever reason, they may not be as sophisticated anymore, mm-hmm. or their faculties may be decaying. But nowadays, I think it's a little bit different. I think the victims, surprisingly, a lot of young people are in there. And this was especially with respect to the cryptocurrency. A lot of young people got tricked into that without knowing what it was about. And nowadays, I think there are two basic classes of persons that you can look at as the prototypical victim, right? There's the person who's extremely fortunate, right? The extremely wealthy, because they have
the money to burn, right? Yep.
They're a natural target. And also the stupid, the people that really don't question or are really accepting of a lot of things and don't really have the background, the education, the skill to really see through schemes. Lack of a better word, stupid. So if you can overlap stupidity and wealth, you have your perfect victim. And that victim does not need to be old by any means.
Yeah, and I think we saw that a lot with cryptocurrency. A lot of people thought they would just be millionaires overnight, and they're just blindly investing without any investigation into what they're investing in.
Oh, that's a key too, by the way. You know, one of the things I love about the complexity of a product or service, the more complex you make it, the easier it is to get people to buy into it, surprisingly. So cryptocurrency, for most people to read a prospectus, an offering memorandum, or any sort of sales or marketing document, probably eyes glaze over at the second paragraph. Mm-hmm. And there's this obfuscation is used intentionally, because if I can't understand it, I'm not going to say I can't understand it. I'm going to pretend that I understand it. And here, take my money. Everybody else is doing it. You know, it's sort of a winning by the intimidation by complexity.
Well, speaking of the elderly, recipients of America's Social Security program, some might consider that a Ponzi scheme. What are your thoughts on that? Is essentially Social Security a government-run Ponzi scheme?
Well, yes, some hold that, but it's not. It doesn't really make sense. I mean, when you think about a Ponzi scheme, right, you're talking about misleading marketing, right, misleading distribution, misleading advertisement, misleading reporting of returns on investment, misleading sources of investment. Social Security, for better and worse, is relatively forthright. You can go to the trustee's report and find out, you know, who's contributing. It's the workers, right? And how much is paid out and what the return is. And people say that often because they say, well, new money is being used to pay old debts, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, very limited and erroneous definition of a Ponzi scheme. Because if that were a Ponzi scheme, you could start looking at banks, you could start looking at corporations on share buybacks. You know, money's often commingled. So you don't really have a situation where, you're using new money? No, it's coming.
Because there's a flow of new money anyways. Yeah,
exactly. So I don't think it's a good analogy. I think it's disingenuous.
Great. So you had mentioned earlier that, you know, some of these smaller operations can fly under the radar pretty easily. Would you say that greed gets the best of these people that get caught? I mean, what's to stop someone from just continuing? I don't know. Let's say you're making six figures a year off a small fraudulent ring. You know, is there always that tendency for these cases that you've seen that they want to get to the next level? And then it eventually catches up to them.
Everybody wants a raise, right? If you could be content with what you have, with a proven method that works, you probably could get away with it for a lot longer. But there's also human nature. And when you think about it, if you can steal 100 grand successfully over 3 months, right? Well, why not steal 250 grand over 3 months? Why not?
Yeah, I feel like it would just snowball and snowball bigger and bigger, where you're like, I did it once, I could do it again.
Yeah, you get cocky, you get overconfident, then you start to make mistakes, and then you have something extraneous in the market occur, and suddenly you have no liquidity, and then the excrement hits the fan.
Would you say that there's a lot of smaller Ponzi schemes being broke up and caught, you know, a lot more than we hear about? I'm just wondering if you have any idea of the numbers of operations that are actually busted up every year in the United States.
I read some public reports state that approximately a Ponzi scheme a week is detected, and about $1 million or so is the damages.
Okay.
I'm sorry, 100 million on average. But last year, apparently, there were 60 plus Ponzi schemes detected with $5.3 billion worth of funds.
Wow.
In state and federal. So it really spiked last year. But that goes back to your earlier point about liquidity crunches when you compared 2008. You know, it's the liquidity crunch. They get found out. A Ponzi scheme cannot continue. And you hear mainstream investors say it in not so many words, like Warren Buffett. Well, it's good when credit becomes tight, because then you'll see who's swimming naked.
Yeah, the waves come in and come out. Yeah, that's his whatever his quote is. Yeah,
see who the cheats are, but
yep.
Like say so.
Can you give us some more insight into how the SEC works? So, what is there a certain threshold or number of complaints against an operation that the SEC will get involved? Maybe put a special investigator on it. Like I think we saw in that Madoff series that, you know, the SEC, they were pretty lackadaisical about him. They would come in, Bernie would make them feel good, and they'd leave. Is there a certain point where the SEC assigns maybe a special investigator onto something after a number of complaints, a certain dollar amount that may be under management? Is there any kind of threshold like that in the SEC's structure?
Yeah, the threshold would be materiality, which can be variable. It can be a certain monetary amount plus other circumstances. Now, what you have to understand with the SEC is that the decision to investigate, and remember, the SEC only creates civil or administrative charges. They don't file criminal charges.
Okay.
But what prompts them to action is the central commission, the five commissioners based in Washington, D.C. So you have a tightly controlled influence process where you can't have, for better and worse, independent SEC executives in Cincinnati or New York City or Miami making decisions as to what to investigate or not. It's centrally controlled, and they will tell you it's for uniformity, for making sure that the standards are upheld.
So the branch offices are pretty limited in what they can do. It all has to come out of the main headquarters.
Exactly. Exactly. So, but I can tell you from an investigator's perspective, that's very disheartening, because it takes the steam, the fire out of investigations. And in light of the Madoff thing, one of the interesting comments you might want to read or editorial would be, I don't know if you remember the guy Gary Aguirre.
Yeah, I think that name sounds familiar. Yeah.
And he went very public with, like, you know, they intentionally deep six this. It was a horrible experience. So with Bernie Madoff, you get hints of something even worse than a monetary amount, right? You get hints of perhaps something more corrupt was going on. And if you look, there's an OIG report, a public report, that sort of says, no, we didn't find any undue influence exercised by Madoff members through his relatives working at the SEC. It's a redacted public version. I would like to see the private version, but one has to question how Madoff could get away with it for so long. And also, the Madoff thing offers another interesting perspective that I know you're interested in, is the role of banks in this process. Mm-hmm. So you had JP Morgan Chase enter a deferred prosecution agreement because of their activity in supporting through transactions the activities of the Madoff Ponzi scheme.
They were holding about $9 billion of his funds. So you can't have that dollar amount to me and say that the bank had no idea what's going on.
Yeah. Well, the theory that they want to use in defense is we're a mere conduit. We just take orders, right? But as you say, if they know more, if they have reason to know more, and they should have reason to know more, because mm-hmm. the Bank Secrecy Act requires suspicious activity transactions to be publicly filed with FinCEN.
Yep.
So, you know, it's harder to get out of it now with, you know, just claiming, oh, I'm just an ostrich. I don't see anything. I don't hear anything.
So also in Madoff's case, was there any ramifications for the SEC on their part of negligence? Because, you know, as we saw, they had plenty of opportunities to seek this out and even had reporters send them hard data about what was going on. And it took many, many years after that for this to get exposed. Is there any kind of, you know, responsibility laid on the SEC for being so late to the game on this?
Well, yes and no. Yeah, there were undoubtedly specific employees there that paid a price, whether working at the OIG or whether working in the examination departments. But there was no systemic change to the SEC.
So in terms of punishment, is that just losing your job? Was there anything beyond that? Or
yeah, it's pretty much, okay, there were some, I won't say bad apples, I'll say ineffective, perhaps incompetent at times actors, but the battle's still good.
Interesting. So would you say that, like many other government agencies, you know, there's a lot of talk about the IRS being understaffed, way behind, you know, they're not even going to bother auditing people making under a certain amount of money. Is the SEC kind of the same way? Are they very understaffed and overwhelmed with what they need to do?
Well, you know, there is not a government agency in the United States that's going to claim that they're overstaffed.
Sure.
So it's difficulty to assess that. What you can, through their own self-assessments, you can find out how many cases they opened, how many cases they resolved, and so forth. But just as a microcosm of that, if you look at their allegations of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act violations as a subset, it takes them years. It takes them years to do anything, and they very rarely go against individuals. They go against, you know, legal fictions, corporations. And that's a rather safe way to enforce the law, because, you know, okay, the corporation pays. Let's continue business as usual.
I feel like it's kind of an excuse for a lot of these guys to get into doing these crimes, because the punishment seems pretty light in comparison to, let's say, a violent crime or whatever it may be. Like, why would I jump into that world when I can potentially make millions of dollars and the punishment is, you know, a mere fraction of what a similar crime might be? Like robbing a bank. Let's say you rob a bank or you actually wire funds fraudulently from a bank, the punishments are very not the same. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's crazy, isn't it? Why anybody would rob a bank is beyond me. Besides the personal risk of engaging in a physical violent crime, the likelihood of obtaining much cash is remote. Mm-hmm. Banks don't hold a lot of cash. So
yeah.
You're not going to get away with a lot. But people often don't have the courage or ingenuity to perpetrate white collar crimes, because it requires more planning. It's not exactly an impulse crime,
sure,
but people can't see the benefits. And plus, if you rip off a bank, even financially, the penalties can be severe. It can be up to 20 years or so in prison. But it's just, if you look at the stats, the U.S. at the federal level is investigating and prosecuting so few white-collar crimes over the past 10 years. It's a joke. It's a joke. I say that. I could be wrong. Here's how I could be wrong. If, as a society, we've evolved to the extent that we're more moral, we have more integrity, we're generally obeying laws and so forth, and then in which case I say, well, you know what? The fact that you're not prosecuting nearly as many white-collar crimes as you used to makes sense because it's not out there. But I think the key stat, though, for us to go back to is the Ponzi scheme stat of last year, the $5.3 billion, the 60 plus, more than amounts of a long time. I think that these agencies, both criminal investigation agencies and public prosecutors, have a lot to answer for because their discretion on whether or not to investigate or prosecute is largely unchecked. So it's hard to get a sense of, you know, why this, not that. How many have you ignored? What did you dismiss? What did you choose not to investigate? And without that kind of information, it's hard to independently assess the SEC. Sure, you can read their self-assessment for what it's worth.
So that brings me to one last point before we get out of here. I think you can help solve this a little bit. You had mentioned that the SEC does not file criminal charges, which is, I think, helpful in this. I'm wondering if you can break down some of the federal structure on how what agency gets what when it comes to financial crime. So is there a certain point where the SEC will turn over the case to the FBI? Do they work collaboratively? Are there other agencies? I think even like the Secret Service investigates fraud.
Counterfeiting and so forth. Yes.
How does this all work? Because we know the government runs like a mess, and now you're involving multiple agencies. I'm just wondering, kind of, I guess, the power structure of how it works at the federal level.
Well, you have another wrinkle in the states, which many other countries don't have. You have the outsourcing of regulation to the independent sector, non-government agencies like the NFA or FINRA,
right,
which other countries don't use. So we have those two monitors and regulators, which are non-for-profits. Then we have at the federal level, we have the SEC, the CFTC, the Secret Service, and they can create referrals to the FBI generally. It's called a criminal referral, and the FBI will investigate for purposes of possible criminal prosecution. But it has various steps to it. So the SEC has to refer it, step number one. Step number two, the FBI has to accept it and investigate it further, step number two. Step number three, they have to refer to an assistant U.S. attorney who may choose to prosecute or not. And that's kind of the way it goes, emanating from Washington, D.C. headquarters. It's the only real complaint I have about the system is the lack of transparency.
I think that's any government agency, though.
trust me. No, but honestly, though, I'm not anti-government. I like the government. I work for the government. I work for the private sector. A lot of what the government does is very good because the private sector wouldn't do it unless the government does. You know, whether, you know, repairing bridges, tunnels, and so forth. So the government does some good things. It's just that when the government is not transparent and I can't say whether it's good or not, then I have an issue with it.
I do want to get one question in from my co-host, Sam, I had mentioned earlier, because he actually fell victim to a scheme lately, and I want to run it by you. He thankfully was able to get his money back. He's going to talk about it on the show soon for anybody listening out there. But he had actually bought into a development deal for a condo building in Thailand. You know, they did one of those flashy marketing seminars, say, hey, this is what we're doing. You just got to give a down payment and the building will be done in however many months, years, / whatever. Well, this guy decided to take the checks and run out of town. He wants to know, first of all, what's this scheme called, if you've heard of similar schemes, and does this type of thing happen in the U.S. too that you've seen?
Well, yeah, that's your garden variety financial fraud, whether it could be bank fraud too, depending on who else contributed. Embezzlement is in there, false financial statements in there. But to your central question, here's where a definition of Ponzi scheme is important. Because remember, we talked about Ponzi schemes being characterized by misleading marketing. Oh, I have a way to get you 100% return on buying overseas stamps per Charles Ponzi, right?
Sure.
Oh, you know, here, but yeah, invest with me. Then you have the fraudulent, the misleading reporting. Oh, we made this amount this year. Oh, I'm going to keep my money in, like Madoff. Oh, he's making too much money for us. Leave it in.
Yeah.
So by those criteria, you have a similar, you know, the real estate fraud is no different. The same the same techniques, you know, trick the investors, mislead them, and keep them guessing while the operation implodes.
That's a good note to go out on. I'm sure we'll hear more from Sam about the details on that story. David, I think we could talk about this for many, many hours. I'm glad we got at least a surface level scrape on this. And I think it's important for our listeners to really be mindful of these schemes that are out there, because a lot of people listening to our show are very savvy and want to jump into multiple investments. And it's just a good reminder that there's always a lot of risk out there. Can you give us some good resources for listeners to go learn more about how to spot potential financial fraud? Maybe any good books or articles that you're aware of?
Well, besides the non-for-profit regulators like FINRA, NFA, the SEC, Secret Service, US DOJ will have a site, FBI will have a site, all providing good advice. The AC, Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, will have a site. The Association of Independent Certified Public Accountants will have a site. There's lots of information out there, but it's not so easy to apply, right? So I think if I could make any suggestion, there are a lot of these sources, but people have to learn the skill of freedom of thought. Because often with these schemes, they're characterized by a sort of wave of agreement, a popularity, a momentum that people find often hard to challenge. So let me just go with it. And I think what people need to do, besides using resources of those sites, is to recognize that each case is somewhat unique and each case has to be examined. The statements have to be examined. What's in there that could be a misrepresentation? What's not in there, a material omission? And by the way, that's often the most difficult to discern, but also the most common way of committing fraud, leaving out key details. Oh, by the way, that vendor we do business with, it's my wife's company, you know, and also obfuscation, obfuscation, which is classic with cryptocurrency and blockchain.
That's great. We'll leave links to all that in our notes and anywhere else that listeners can go to learn more about you, David, maybe take one of your courses.
Yeah. If they're curious, I'm on the John Jay website. You'll find me in the directory, David Shapiro. I'm in the Department of Public Management. My CV is there. You know, for better and worse, my abstract is there. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I appreciate you coming on Invest Like a Boss.
My pleasure, Derek. Thank you for inviting me. Have a good one.
This week's sponsor of Invest Like a Boss is NetSuite by Oracle. Now, we know we have a lot of bosses out there with their own business, and many of you are earning millions or even tens of millions in revenue. And if you fall into that category, you need to stop everything you're doing right now, because NetSuite by Oracle has just rolled out the best offer we've ever seen. For the first time in NetSuite's 22-year history as the number one cloud financial system, you can defer payments for a full NetSuite implementation for 6 months. That's no payments and no interest for 6 months. NetSuite is number one because they give your business everything you need in real time, all in one place, to reduce manual processes, boost efficiency, build forecasts, and increase productivity across every department. 33,000 companies have already upgraded to NetSuite, gaining visibility and control of their financials, inventory, HR, e-commerce, and more. So take advantage of this special financing offer today. It is unprecedented. No interest, no payments when you head to netsuite.com/ilab. That's netsuite, netsuite.com/ilab, ILAB. You'll get visibility and control of everything your business needs to weather any storm. Check out netsuite.com/ilab.
Our Derek themes: SEC fails, people are greedy, board of directors is often a front, banks are corrupt, massively diversified.
That's why I don't feel so bad after listening to that, because I know you and I are in the same boat where we just got everything spread out so wide that unless there's a massive conspiracy that everyone's in on and everything's a scheme, I think you and I are okay. But there are a lot of people that find that one big investment like Madoff or whoever it may be, and they're like, I'm putting everything with them. This is my guy.
God, that was like one of the most eye-popping pieces of that series. And it was like, they interviewed all these people that 100% with Madoff. And I'm just like, how? But it would literally be so easy, right? I mean, how many people do you know that's never listened to, read an investing book, or
so many people?
had an investing account.
Or just have that one job for their entire life and they just know one thing. Mm-hmm. They got a one retirement account. That's all they have. And I get really frustrated because we do this investment podcast that is free for many people to listen to. And I'll tell people about it and they're just like, oh yeah, whatever. Sure. That sounds good. And then they'll never do anything about it. I'm like, just do it for yourself. I have nothing to gain out of this.
Yeah. Derek, they don't need it because they have a 401k advisor.
Yeah, exactly. Taking a hefty management fee.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the truth is like a lot of times if all you did was put your money into an index fund for 20 years while you're working, collecting a paycheck, and did nothing and didn't think about it and didn't get into alternative investments,
it might be the best idea out there.
where most people in that boat can make an edge is getting rid of the fees.
Right.
Like that's such a huge, huge takeaway from the 250 episodes is like your 1% or 1.5% or 2% fees that you're paying add up to insane amounts of money over the course of 30 or 40 years. On 1 year, it's like, oh, it's nothing. But over the course of time, it's retiring wealthy versus retiring on a pinched budget. But I liked what it was saying about like often a board of directors is like a front. Not a front, but you get people on the board that are kind of face guys or girls, but they really have like a lot of people on the board are like passively involved, right? And in order to really know what's going on, even in a very small business, like a startup, it's very difficult to understand what's happening in the financials because often you have very many lines of revenue, and it's hard to figure out where those transactions are coming from. You can imagine on a corporation that's like a public corporation that's generating tens or hundreds of millions of dollars a quarter in revenue. Like you're just going to take what people tell you. Like you're not going to be doing financial due diligence on those books. I can almost guarantee it. And even if you did, you wouldn't necessarily be able to spot fraud.
I found that interesting too. I used to work with someone that was on the board of multiple Fortune 500 companies, and he would fly in for the board meeting, fly out maybe the next day, probably the same day. And I bet you he couldn't tell you one fact about the company. It was just, it was a paycheck.
Yeah. And often these board, I mean, there's a lot of people whose dream and their goal financial or professionally is just to be sitting on a few boards. Mm-hmm. That's like the holy grail of being in a corporation and like climbing the ladder. It's like, get to a point where you can just be on a few boards. Oftentimes you get 100K to 200K a year.
Stock options.
You're working like 2 hours a month. Like you're not going to ask the hard questions. You're not going to be pressing them. You're going to be trying to give them strategic support.
You're just happy to be there. I mean, it's such a cush gig, honestly.
Get flown in, have a couple drinks, smoke a cigar, slap some hands, you know, good, great gig.
Yeah. So I found that interesting. And also the fact that, I mean, it shouldn't be surprising that the government is extremely inefficient. And he basically said, if you don't get too greedy, I mean, Madoff got away with it for 30 years or so, but he said, you know, if you don't get too greedy, you can probably fly under the radar on this. I'm not suggesting anyone goes out and starts a Ponzi scheme, but he's saying, you know, if you're in the low millions or whatever it may be, enough for multiple people to have plenty of money, they're probably not going to find you.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking because you would think like over the course of 4 or 5 years, you would have a dry spell where you can't get people to invest or someone digs into the books a lot. I would think most of these Ponzi schemes are not your typical investments. You know, there'll be some type of alternative investment or some type of international trade. I think the original Ponzi scheme was foreign currency, like something that's really difficult to understand and to track trades of. But you would think somebody along the line would get deep into like the due diligence and then start talking about it. But I guess in often cases it doesn't. But it was alarming to hear how many Ponzi schemes are being broke up each year.
Yeah, what was it like 600 or so last year? And he said it's gone up since, you know, the economy started collapsing a little bit. It's gone up, you know, multiple folds. So I think we were right in our theory that, you know, when the economy starts to break up, that's when these things start to get exposed.
You think like people that are starting these Ponzi schemes, they think they've just like, they don't even know really what a Ponzi scheme is. It's just like they are running some type of business. And then they're like, wow, this is sort of an opportunity. Maybe I can like take people that are putting money in, give previous investors money out. And like, they don't even know what it's called. They're like, I think this whole strategy will work. And they think they've embarked on something that is like multi-level marketing or something. And turns out they're running a fraud.
Yeah. It's not like there's a playbook to do this, but they all kind of end up in the same place at the end where it's like,
yeah,
the strategy was the same, but they all do it a little differently. It's not like there's copycats out there of the exact same business model.
Cause I just don't see how people, I mean, it's a big number of how many schemes are getting broke up by what sounds like government agencies. And they're not going after everyone. They're just going after the bigger ones, which means there's probably, you know, 10x the amount of schemes actually going on that are smaller and kind of under the radar and right, not being broke up.
He said it just takes one thing to get a little too greedy, and then that's when you get caught. But he alluded that a lot of these could go on for years and years and years if they just kept it the same strategy. But you always want to level up.
You just always want to level up. I just can't imagine people are sitting around like thinking, like they understand what a Ponzi scheme is. They understand how to structure it. They understand they're conducting fraud. And they're like, and that's their idea. It's like, we're going to start a Ponzi scheme. I think people just fall into doing this by some type of like mishap in operations. And then they're like, well, I think this could actually work and scale. And like,
yeah,
let's go with it.
I think
it.
The Ponzi scheme as we know it, they don't necessarily start out as like, this is what I'm going to do. But the people he mentioned, like going after identity theft or these shit coins and crypto, they know what they're doing. But yeah. I think a lot of these general Ponzi schemes, I don't want to say they start off as a legitimate investment, but I think some do. I mean, even Madoff, at least the way they pose it, was that he was a legitimate investing firm, and it just, he found out a little loophole, and then it just grew bigger and bigger and bigger.
You know, one way that you could see this happening is like in the case of Madoff, and I don't think this was his case, but let's say you have a legitimate business going on in this type of industry, like you're trading, and you get a bunch of new money in, but you can't deploy the new money because it's more money than you can deploy in your trading business, right?
Right.
Like for instance, like Rentec, you know, they have like too much investor demand, but the types of investments they make can't absorb that type of capital, right? So that I feel like that's where it can go off the rails. Is like you get a bunch of new money in, you're like, shit, I can't deploy this money, which means it's just sitting idle. But yet these people are expecting my historic returns of like 12%. And so things start going off the rails there, right? You get a bunch of new money in, you're like, well, I'll just pay out some, you know, I'll just do this once. I'll just pay out some old investors with some new money. And then like, well, that worked and no one asked questions. And
I think a lot of these people are afraid to have a bad year, which we know how the market works. You're going to have a bad year some year. And if you're giving 10, 12% every single year and you all of a sudden have a bad year, I think a lot of these people are just afraid that everyone's going to cash out.
Yeah. All right. So on the topic of Ponzi, obviously, we're talking about it. I'm not sure what you would call this, but let me tell you what happened, Derek. And you put a term on it. And I know you raised it in the episode. So this is actually quite hard to find. They're keeping it under wraps. And I know why. So I invested in a property pre-construction in Thailand and down in Phuket.
Condo building, obviously, right?
Yeah, it was supposed to be delivered in 2018. And it was 2020. And they kept saying like it was on you know, a couple of delays, but everything was good. And I sent someone down that I knew in Phuket to go look at the property. And basically, it hadn't even broken ground. And when I called the 1-800 number to speak to their customer service, figure out what's going on, the developer himself picked up the line.
Ooh, that's now, this not
is
a good
like,
sign.
This is like a multi, this is like probably a $500 million to $1 billion development, like huge resort.
He should not be answering his own phone.
Right. Yeah. So that was like the big alarm. And then I researched this guy's name and I find it's some Italian developer. And I find an article about him that he wrote about himself. He self-published an article about how he became a billionaire.
Oh, no.
Developing land overseas. And it was this
red flag
sleazy
one,
article.
Red flag two.
Oh, yeah. So those are two big red flags. So I got my... And by the way, they were 2 years late on delivering and it didn't look like they're anywhere close to finish. So I got my attorney involved. Fortunately, it was about 6 months of proceedings back and forth. We didn't have to go to court. They agreed to pay out my entire deposit back, which at that point was about 70,000 US. And they paid it out 12 months in a row consecutively, with my last payment being on January 2020, right as COVID was breaking out. As far as I know, I'm the only one that got my money out. There was 400 other investors and they were all invested between 70,000 and 100,000. So if you run the quick math, that's up to 40 million US. And long story short, the building is not completed. The news that came to break was that he was using the money, the investor's deposit, to finish other buildings that he had in Thailand and abroad. And then that kind of the pool ran out there and those other buildings didn't finish. And then he just hit tail and run. And now, as far as I know, he's on the run under like a fake name and fake accounts, fake passport. So I don't think it's a Ponzi scheme, but sure as hell rhymes with one.
I mean, it sounds like a Ponzi scheme. You're taking care of other investors with the money that you gave for a separate investment.
Yeah. And
so he had multiple buildings, but he never even finished one. Like, why not? This is what I don't get. Why not put everything into one building, finish that one, and then that building's probably profitable at that point?
Because that's not how you become a billionaire, Derek.
I guess all I have to do is write an article and says I'm a billionaire. But you got paid out. So that's actually one thing, though, too, because like relating it back to Madoff, I can't remember the guy's name, but the big guy that got most of his money back and made a lot of money off Madoff, he was paid out because a lot of people would argue that he knew what was going on. So he kind of had Bernie over the coals to pay him out anyways. But there were a lot of people that invested with Madoff that did actually make money and got paid out. As long as there's enough people that aren't complaining and don't want their money back, you have that huge fund of money still. Where obviously, he still had enough money to pay you.
Yes. And I guess, well, you know, I got paid out my principal, but actually I ended up losing money on the transaction, right? Because I had to get lawyers involved. And it was...
And what was the reasoning for breaking it up into payments? He didn't have 70 grand after raising 40 million?
Of course he probably had it. He just didn't want to pay it. Like, why pay it out all at once if you can pay it out over 12 months? And I agreed.
Sure.
You know, instead of going to court. At this point, I thought it was just a delayed project. I didn't think it was some type of total fraud, right?
So what happens next with that? The site ever even broke ground on the one that you invested in?
I don't know what's happening with it right now. I think they were able to seize the property and get some other developer to kind of take it over. I have no idea what's going to happen with the current investors. Like, they're going to need to put in more money to finish the project, right? Where does that money come from? Thailand's doing a good job of keeping it all under wraps because I think it's kind of embarrassing that this has happened. And obviously, this is not the only case. Like, it's basically, unfortunately, it's common ground. Like, you hear stories of like this. We talked about it on numerous episodes. You hear lots of stories like this down in Thailand. You need more regulation of some sort. But unfortunately, it's so corrupt that people turn a cheek, turn an eye to it if they're getting a payout, which they often are. But what's scary, like in the case of Ponzi schemes also, is like if you're an investor and you make a profit on it, they'll come for you.
Right.
You know? Like in Madoff, you saw they went hard at these people and made them sell assets that they had, like houses and stuff, and liquidate. So like, you can get paid out, get all your money back, but then they might come for it and take it all back and then distribute it across everyone else that lost. So it can get like the cuts can be very deep and very long.
Yeah. So even if you realize that you're in a Ponzi scheme, you ask for all your money back and you get it back, they could come after you later on too. That would suck.
One other thing I thought was kind of cool. What were your thoughts on his comments about Social Security being a fraud?
I wanted to ask you about that. Let me clarify that was Sam's question because he shut me down immediately. He's like, what am I talking to, some conspiracy theorist? Like, immediately he's like, nope, it's not a Ponzi scheme. Yeah. I wanted to be like, this is Sam's question. I didn't write this.
Some people maintain, but it's a false view. I pushed ChatGPT on it. It came up with really, really awesome responses, as you'd expect at this point. But ChatGPT also agrees. I won't give you like the initial four paragraphs that it wrote on why it's not a Ponzi scheme. But actually, by ChatGPT's definition of a Ponzi scheme, I was like, oh, well, by your definition, it sure sounds like Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. And then I pressed it on that basis and it came up with the following response. Well, there's several key differences between Social Security and a Ponzi scheme. One was legitimacy. Two is the way contributions are structured. Three is the benefits that are based on a set formula that takes into account individuals' work history and contributions. And four is sustainability, which actually doesn't seem
as guaranteed.
Unless it's bailed out with money that's just conjured out of thin air.
Which we know will probably happen. But I'm not too concerned about that because I'm not going to see barely anything for Social Security. I don't think you will either, Sam, because neither of us have really had a real job in a long time.
Yeah, it's true. I got pretty much nothing in Social Security at this point.
Yeah, I haven't had like a W-2 job in I think over 10 years now. So whatever little pittance I get, if there's anything left, is not going to be worth anything.
But Derek, however will you save for your retirement if you're not supported by Social Security?
Well, I got to find a 401k manager, I guess.
Social Security, good intentions, but not necessary.
One other thing, let's talk about one more thing before we get out of here. Cryptocurrency, I mean, we brought it up a lot. I thought it was funny that he's basically saying FBI or whatever government agency it may be, they like that it has this supposed secrecy about it, that you can hide money in cryptocurrency in the blockchain, when in all reality, it's all recorded. Like, basically every move you make in crypto is on the blockchain. It's all recorded like an accountant's spreadsheet. And these stupid criminals don't realize that. And he's like, the government agencies love that. They want to keep it that way, that the public thinks you can hide money in here.
There's a lot of that going on right now, right? Like drug dealers and all types of people that are putting money into crypto right now, thinking that they can like launder it, and they're just being tracked at some point. But it's the same type of thing with Ponzi schemes. It's like, if you're a small fish and you're not doing anything extravagant, there's probably a limit to where you start getting investigated and tracked. But they can always come back and look at, you know, quote unquote paper trail if you do something wrong in the future. So everyone that's in crypto, just be careful what you're doing with it.
And really quick, can you give us an update on Mt. Gox, Sam? It's been a while since we talked about it. I know, I thought you were really, really close, but I don't think you've got your Bitcoin yet, right?
Not got Bitcoin. They keep sending out letters, delaying everything 3 months to 6 months at a time. I just shared this in Boss Lounge recently. Like, I thought I was getting paid out this month, and it turns out now they're saying October.
It's just like, it's like a plane delay, like 15 minutes. You know, it's not gonna be 15 minutes. And then when 15 minutes hit, it's gonna be an hour. Then it's 2 hours.
Do you know how many people are dying each time like they delay this? I think there's like tens of thousands of people, or at least 10,000 people that are claimants.
Yeah. And you're years in. So there's gotta be a lot of people that have died since.
Yeah. Or 10 years in, right? So a lot of people are probably out. I wonder how they're handling. There's just going to be a ton of money that is never distributed, because no one knows how to, no one would have known how to like put a beneficiary on the account of this claim.
And, oh yeah. When you didn't even know what Bitcoin was back in 2008 or whatever it was.
And it's a lot of younger people, right? So if they did put a beneficiary on, it's probably their parents,
who might be dead too. Yeah.
Kids. Yeah. Or like, how's your mom going to figure out how to get your Bitcoin from Mt. Gox? Right?
I just had to teach my mom how to do like something very basic on Facebook, much less figure out Bitcoin.
It's not super easy. Even if I've been following it for 10 years, like you have to go set up new accounts at different exchanges you never heard of to get the Bitcoin payout. And we'll see. We'll see. The other thing that I thought was important that he brought up was just how much regulation they're considering and putting on the table for cryptocurrency. I don't know how far that will extend, if it would just be like the regulation would be peer-to-peer, or if it would just be whoever's issuing or minting and issuing the cryptocurrency initially. But that potentially could crash cryptocurrency much, much further than where it is now.
I think we're years out on that anyways, because just like our parents not being able to figure out stuff, the average age of a US senator is like 74. And if you listen to these meetings that they have on this stuff, like when Mark Zuckerberg testified in front of Congress, he just schooled all of them and just made them all look so like ridiculously stupid because they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, but at the same time, a lot of people are losing a shitload of money right now in crypto from speculation, but also from fraud, from Mt. Gox, from FTX. And like, once enough people start losing money on it, action starts happening pretty quick. So I think it's just something to be very cautious about when you're thinking about investing in cryptocurrencies of all types. I don't even know if it could affect Bitcoin at this point, since Bitcoin's, it's not like being issued anymore, right? You can mine it and you can trade it peer-to-peer. But yeah, the implications could potentially get quite broad. And any regulation, I think, will affect prices to the downside. I can't see how it would improve it. Maybe legitimacy, I don't know.
Well, I'm 100% out of all cryptocurrencies and I couldn't be happier. So
I gave all of my non-Bitcoin away about 6 months ago. So I just have what's coming from Mt. Gox and a few other ones on a hard drive somewhere.
Nice. All right. We should get out of here, but I want to give a special thank you to our listeners lately, because the economy has been a little weird. Sponsorships have kind of dried up a little bit. We've mentioned this before, but you guys have really been stepping up in Patreon, and we've been giving some awesome new content inside Patreon too, which is pretty cool. So if you're not a member yet of Patreon, you should head over to investlikeaboss.com. You can get a membership as low as $5 a month. And that $5 doesn't just give you like one piece of content. We have 3 years of stuff in there now. So if you've never joined Patreon, you can go back and you can get hundreds of posts, bonus episodes in there. We just talked, Sam just had a big company exit that he talks about how he's going to distribute those funds and take a year long sabbatical. sounds pretty awesome. We also have some more thoughts on some bad Thailand investments. If you want to go in there, there's lots of information on that. Quarterly updates were just done. So much stuff. There's a lot of good value in there. So I hope you guys will check that out. And any Patreon that is already a member, we really appreciate the support.
Yeah. And speaking of, we're looking to host a meetup in Barcelona, most likely the last weekend of May. So a little bit short notice. About 3 weeks away now. I think Johnny might try to come. Derek, not likely.
If you're fueling up the company jet, I'm in.
Yeah, right. So if anyone's interested in joining that, check out Patreon. There's a post in there about it. Just register your interest. And depending on how many people are looking to come, we'll start circulating details. But hopefully we'll get together, go to some vineyards, go out on a boat, and have some great tapas and wine.
Sounds awesome. And hopefully we don't run across any kind of Ponzi schemes in our own investments any further going here. If you guys found anything that you want to alert that maybe other listeners might be invested in as well, post it in the Boss Lounge or like in Patreon too. And if you want to kind of keep it on the down though, because you're embarrassed that you got involved in a Ponzi scheme, just send us a direct message so we can share it with people. We won't call you
anonymous. Anonymous. Yeah, and we can have David Shapiro investigate it if we find anything that looks worth looking into.
Oh, I like that idea. Yeah, send over these shady companies. We'll have them look into it. All right, Sam, we're going to get out of here. Hopefully I'll see you in Barcelona in a few weeks.
Yeah, man. Weather is perfect. It feels like you're walking through heaven when you step outside. I'm telling you, trees are in bloom. It's 25 degrees in the day, 15 at night, crisp air. People are happy. It's like on days like this in Barcelona, you wonder why like anyone with the ability to relocate and with the means is not coming here. It's pretty damn good.
I could challenge you with this LA weather. It's pretty fantastic right now too.
Derek sent me a video of him walking downtown. I don't think you're going to challenge me, buddy.
You just got to find the right neighborhood. I have found the correct neighborhood and I don't leave it.
Thanks for listening to the Best Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.